listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 36th installment of our conversation ongoing with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR and the constellation of events around that. And thank you for your time today, Luciana.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're going to be looking, finishing up the myths of Stalin, right?
Yeah, we're in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And I have a little preamble, if you like.
Please do.
Okay. So we are, we're talking about the falsification of history, about the Soviet Union by the West, anti-Soviet propaganda. That was the topic we began last time. Now, falsification is called politely revisionism. And anti-Soviet revisionists, however, don't revise history in the sense of, you know, correcting it. They rewrite it in the shape of really bold lies or untenable apologies. In some cases, they face whole histories. So, for example, the United States have effaced the memory of the Second World War and the resistance of the Soviet people. We, in the Western imaginary, we see this war turn around the question, around the Jewish question, is we liberated, the United States liberated the Jews. If you ask American, that's the answer. Oh, yeah, we liberated the Jews. Forgetting that the colonial ideology, which required Lebensraum, which was the German extension, Lebensraum means room, living room, room to live in,
right,
which was the German extension east, and actually included the program genocide of all the Slav populations. It's not just the Russians. Slavs were inferior people. Right. So that's one example, and I don't want to give more. This revisionism, I think, took off. Well, intensely, 1969, with the publication in English of the Great Terror by Robert Conquest, followed by Solzhenitsyn. It surfaced in Germany with the historian Ernst Nolte. It is alive in France since 2005. And we'll talk about that, okay, in later programs.
Yes.
The history of revisionism sweeping all of Europe. And that is really amounting to the equation that Nazism and Sovietism, Nazism and Sovietism are totalitarian and are equal, morally equal, criminally equal, etc. So, for today. So last week we identified and proposed to examine eight major old Western myths about the Soviet Union. And I'll repeat them. Number one, the collectivization of agriculture was a brutal repression of the peasantry. Number two, that this collectivization caused the famine of 1932-33 and was intended to crush Ukraine's independence from Soviet domination. Number three, that the Great Terror, or Yazovshina, killed 690,000 people. Number four, that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was an alliance between Hitler and Stalin. Number five, that the Soviet Union invaded Poland in September 1939. Number six, that the Katyn massacre of 6,000 Polish officers was carried out by the Soviets. Number seven, that the Warsaw Uprising was a heroic event of Polish nationalism instead of a wanton disaster by anti-Soviet Polish forces. Number eight, that Stalin was anti-Semitic.
Right.
So we discussed one and two and suggested that the collectivization of agriculture is to be considered a reform. And then we discussed and debunked, tried to debunk the myths of the Holodomor. And I'm not going to go into this now. So, but we only touched upon the Great Terror. So these would be the years 1936-39, the years of the Moscow trial, of the three major Moscow trials. So today, I would like to dwell on these trials and on two witnesses of the trials who were not sympathetic to communism, but who nevertheless noted that the trials were not staged, as it is maintained in the West, show trials they're called, that they were not staged to secure the bureaucratic absolutism of Stalin. These two, and before I get to them, I add that today even the most serious anti-communist historians recognize that the figure of the victims of Stalin's purges have been swollen out of proportion, and in fact that the total of people arrested for political reasons and executed from 1921 to 1953 amount to 700,000, which is a considerable amount, but we had to remember the situation in the Soviet Union, the Civil War, and what of the 1920, 21, and several others. So 700,000 as opposed to the 30 million that Conquest said, that I can't remember what million that Timothy Snyder said, and the responsible charges of $100 million that also surfaced. So,
right. Which were so ridiculous. I mean, the population of the USSR was less than 200 million, so you would have seen just like every other man, woman, and or child would have disappeared if they killed 100 million
people. I have somewhere the figures from 1928. There were 147 million people in the Soviet Union, and in 1938, there were 168 million people. These are low figures.
Right.
168, and that the Russian population growth rate was well above that of Western Europe. I can't remember the percentage, 1.42. The highest in Western, compared to Western Europe, except for Italy, amazingly. So, yeah, I mean, the population actually grew.
Right.
So if we, you know...
Where did those 100 million people go?
I don't know. I don't know. They went into ink.
No, it's supposed to be like the, what is it? The rapture. They just disappeared.
They just went
to heaven.
But so the figure of 700,000 that I just got, that I just gave, is really based on one post-Soviet historian named Zhezkov. Zhezkov, and who else? And endorsed by a collaborator of Stephen Cohen, the American historian that wrote the biography of Bukharin. Stephen Cohen is often, you remember him, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Stephen Cohen is an American historian who is much valued among liberal circles because he doesn't demonize Russia, but he nevertheless supported Gorbachev and believed that the Soviet government was an absolutist organ.
Right. Totalitarian.
Yeah. And he collaborated with a very interesting historian named Moshe. It's L-O-E-W-N. But it's pronounced Luvin. Moshe Luvin. He confirms that this 700,000 people arrested for political reasons and executed is a correct. A correct number. Moshe Luvin is a very interesting person, historian. He was born in Russia. He enlisted in the Red Army. He was Polish. He enlisted in the Red Army, then he went to Israel, then he ended up at Columbia, then he ended up at the University of Pennsylvania and died a few years ago, and his papers are stored in the University of Pennsylvania. So he was a communist, or rather a faithful supporter of the Great Patriotic War and fought in it, but nevertheless he was a Bukharinite. And he confirms the Zhezkov number, which comes out of the opening of the Russian archives. So whereas Conquest and Solzhenitsyn and those people wrote before the opening of the archives, this number investigated the KGB files and the juridical files. Okay, is that clear? I didn't mean
yes.
to go into that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
In spite of everything, in fact that there are these important historians in the background, not necessarily communist historians, the myth of the terror under the personal dictatorship of Stalin persists, and never for a moment does it admit that perhaps those condemned in the Moscow trials were really guilty. This is never considered. But we have two witnesses who do admit it and are never mentioned, and they are very important. The first is Joseph Davis.
Right.
He was ambassador of the United States to Moscow during the Moscow trial. And the second one is a British jurist named Britt, to whom I will refer to later.
Yeah, we're talking, now, Britt is Dennis Noel Britt, and he wrote a rather extensive piece of work about it called At the Moscow Trial.
I'm not familiar with that. What? Yep, repeat that, please.
Printed in 1937. It's called At the Moscow Trial. It's he's listed in the customary way in the Soviet Union by D.N. Britt, but it's actually he's a Brit, and his name is he was a British jurist. It's Dennis Noel Britt.
Oh, Dennis, no, I thought you said, I thought it was somebody else. Fine.
That's him, yep.
Yeah. Now, I would like to quote from Davis's testimony extensively. Just feel free to jump in, okay, when you know, to add and stuff. Right. Now, Davis, who was appointed, I suppose, by FDR, because he was in Moscow in 1937, earlier,
right,
too. But anyway, Davis followed, as all the diplomats in Moscow could do and did, he followed the Moscow trials as an observer. And he, too, was a jurist. So on March 17, 1938, this is the last trial, the trial of Bukharin, he sent his impression to Washington on the trial of Bukharin and of others with Bukharin in Moscow. So the dispatch says, in extracts, because this was published in a book in 1943 by Davis. Anyway, extracts. He writes, "Despite my prejudices, after observing the witnesses daily and their manner of deposing, I came to the conclusion that the accused actually violated the Soviet law enumerated in the indictments. And the accusation of high treason, and were actually guilty of the accusation of high treason, so the sentences issued against them were justified. The opinion of the diplomats here, who regularly attended the debates, was unanimous. The trial denounced the existence of a political opposition of the highest level." And then I have some more, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting, by the way.
this is 1938.
No, I know. He goes, he's appointed by
FDR
to go. And by the way, FDR is the one that actually opened relations with the Soviet Union. The United States did the same thing with the USSR that they did with China after the revolution for 20-something years. They refused to refused to recognize the government. But FDR, brought the country, into reality on that point. And then then he sent Davies over. Davies toured the country. And also, by the way, there was a movie made in the 1940s by Michael Curtiz called Mission to Moscow.
I think I saw it.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. Yep.
And it may even be on TCM today, this week sometime, because they've been running Michael Curtiz films. But it's called Mission to Moscow, 1943, based on Davies' book that was published in 1941. And it details his entire experience. He takes a boat over to Europe and tours some of the European capitals, and then goes to Moscow, and then stops back talking to people about what he saw, and then he comes back and reports back to Roosevelt. And at the end of all of that, we end up seeing what unfolded in World War II. And we saw the United States help the Soviet Union essentially take out Hitler. And then when that was over, HUAC, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or actually the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, thought, gee, this is something that should be scrutinized because it says Stalin's repressions, quote-unquote, weren't as we're reporting them. Of course, he went there. These other characters were sitting in committees in Washington. And therefore, this is something that had to be at least repositioned and you know, Davies and anyone around him silenced and or publicly, you know, flogged.
Whoa. Not surprising. Well, listen to this.
This is part of the process of doing what you're describing, though, of fouling the historical record.
Yeah. Well, when we discuss the cult of personality, we're going to come back to Davies and to the rather realistic but sympathetic attitude that Stalin had toward FDR. How he visited him when he was sick in Yalta, how he empathized, in fact said something like, Stalin, something like, how can nature punish a man? So, you know, there was, and then there was a great deal of affection or something for Roosevelt, or at least they could get along. He knew both Truman and Stalin were imperialists, but he could, you know, but Truman was so rude, managerial, pompous, that by comparison, FDR was, you know, was something else.
Patrician.
But anyway, Stalin never forgot that both were imperialists.
Right.
But one was decent and the other one was intolerable.
Right.
I'll come back to that, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was even FDR that referred to Truman as that, you know, that petty little Clark. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I call him that haberdasher.
Right.
He really, anyway, so Ambassador Davies then had already witnessed the trial of Radek and others in 1937, so the previous one. So on February 17th of 1937, he had sent a report to the Secretary of State of the United States, and in it he stated, "Objectivity made me conclude," and he says, "reluctantly," this is 37, so it's a little more cautious tone, "that the state really proved the accusations. There is no doubt about the existence of a very serious conspiracy between the leaders, the accused leaders, against the Soviet government. The violations of the law indicated in the indictment have really been committed and are therefore punishable. I have spoken with practically all the members of the diplomatic corps here present, and except perhaps for one exception," he doesn't mention it,
right,
"everyone is of the opinion that the debates in the trials have established the actual existence of a secret plan and a conspiracy aimed at eliminating the government." Now, what we also need to realize from these type of testimonies is that the repression was not addressed to the people in general, civilian. We think, oh my God, he picked up anybody from the street and shot them, Stalin did. No, this was aimed at the highest level of both
right,
the political and the military institutions.
Right.
It was not a, it's claimed that this was, that Stalin was enforcing the power, his power, and the power of the party. But in fact, it was actually cleaning it out. I don't know how to put it. Anyway, I'll skip that. It was actually directed against the looseness of the party. So I guess in a way, okay, forget it. I got mixed up. So in his diary, March 11th, 1937, Davis, so this is just a few months later, Davis noted this episode. Another diplomat yesterday made an instructive consideration. We talked about the trial, and he said, "The accused are without a doubt guilty. We have all witnessed the trial. We are unanimous. And here comes the clincher. But for the outside world, on the contrary, the description of the trial are staged." And Davis continues, "He knew how this did not respond to the truth, but apparently it was good that the rest of the world did not know it or had this impression." Then another, he actually reports, he talks about Litvinov, the foreign affairs minister, and he talks about Litvinov in July 4th, 1937. He says, Davis talks about numerous arrests and purges on July 4th, 1937, on the orders of Litvinov. And about Litvinov, he reports, Litvinov stated that thanks to these purges, it is certain that no betrayal in favor of Berlin or Tokyo would be possible. One day the world will understand that what was done was necessary. And so then Davis continues, they needed to protect their government from the menacing betrayal. Indeed, they have rendered service to the whole world, preserving from the danger of Hitler's Nazis, preserving it from the danger of Hitler's Nazi world domination. The Soviet Union is a strong bastion against the National Socialist danger. A day will come when the whole world will be able to recognize what a great man Stalin was, he says in 1937, July. Now, another, can I go on with these quotations?
Yeah, do. Yeah, no, this is good. Yeah, do. Definitely, yeah. Do.
So the description of Davis's conversation with Stalin was contained in the letter of 9 June 1938, a year later, than the Litvinov report, to his daughter. He wrote to his daughter, and it's rich in lessons. He was impressed by Stalin's personality, and he says to his daughter, "If you can imagine a totally different character in every sense from what his most ferocious adversaries have come to describe, then you have an image of this man. The situation I see here and his personality are diametrically opposed." So we're getting towards the end, but so after the fascist aggression of the Soviet Union in June 1941, Davis summarized his view in 1941, saying that, quote, "The trials of high treason have routed Hitler's fifth column." So that such names as Bukharin and Trotsky in absence, Zinoviev, Kamenev, they apparently were a fifth column. So we could say that, and Brecht had said this, these were people who had become isolated and had fallen into sabotage and terrorism, and that they saw in the defeat of the USSR a potential for coming to power. Now, this is not necessarily power politics. This could be just that they didn't agree, and Bukharin didn't agree with Stalin since 1928. Trotsky never, but well, this, right. This will be back on this. In 1936, the trials against Zinoviev and others took place. And here, the British lawyer, the one you mentioned, the Prit,
yes.
The Prit lawyer who was right. AKC, a King's Counsel,
right.
Wrote his impressions in the book From Right to Left, released in 1965 in London. And he wrote, "My impression is that the trial was conducted fairly and that the accused were really guilty. The same feeling is shared by all the journalists with whom I could speak. And certainly all the foreign observers thought, there were many, especially diplomats, thought so. I heard one of them say, this is Prit. Of course they are guilty, but for reasons of propaganda, we have to deny the journalists and the diplomats, but the journalists too. So it's story yesterday, same as today. The journalists knew there's no attack in Douma. They know what writing.
That's right.
So now, in conclusion, if we assume that Davies and Prit and Brecht, whom I didn't quote, who said the same thing, if Davies and Prit were correct in their judgment on the trial of Moscow, and if we assume that they were right, then we must necessarily ask a question. People like Khrushchev and Gorbachev, who declared innocent the victims, who declared innocent victims the convicts of the Moscow trials, did they not do it because they sympathized with them? Well, certainly we know Gorbachev sympathized with Bukharin tremendously because he had read Stephen Cohen's biography of Gorbachev. We know that. Or were they even accomplices? Now, Gorbachev is too young for that, but Khrushchev certainly can be, that question can be asked of Khrushchev. And so they wanted to put an end to the Soviet Union as it was. And that's my report, shall we say, on people who disagreed that the Moscow trials were staged.
And we got to stop there. So thank you very much, Luciana. We're going to pick it up at this point next week.
Great. Thanks, Don.
Thank
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. 20 years after the prohibition of chemical weapons was introduced as an international norm, sarin and chlorine are back as a means of warfare. Actual warfare on the battlefield, if you believe the West, or the warfare of disinformation and dirty scheming, if you believe Russia. What is worse? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Paul Walker, director of Green Cross International's Environmental Security and Sustainability Program. Dr. Walker, it's a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, nice to be here, Oksana, too. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, you've been leading this program since its very inception. I assume you care a lot about the non-proliferation of chemical weapons. How would you describe this moment in time when we have a number of Western countries accusing Russia of not only shielding the alleged user of chemical weapons, but also using those chemical weapons itself?
You know, the whole current situation is very troubling, Oksana, and I've been working on chemical weapons and their nonproliferation and their safe and sound and irreversible destruction for 25 years, since I first did one of the very first Western American inspections in Russia in a place called Shucha in the Kurgan Oblast. This was back in 1994. We've all worked to universalize the Chemical Weapons Convention. We have 192 countries who have joined. Today, the Chemical Weapons Convention, with only four outstanding, and we haven't had any chemical weapons used, really, except, you know, back in the 80s when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, and we had in the mid-90s when the terrorist group in Japan, Aum Shinrikyo, tried to use sarin nerve agent in the Tokyo subways. And so this These latest occurrences in Syria, number one, since really 2012, accusations were made originally in late 2012 that Syria was using chemical weapons. But then Syria joined the convention, of course, under pressure from the bilateral sides, from Russia and the United States. And now this whole Skripal assassination attempt in England is just very troubling. There are weekly meetings of the Executive Council and the OPCW trying to figure out what to do and what's true and who's to blame. And, of course, we all know that there have been a number of recent meetings, just a couple days ago, the last one of the UN Security Council as well.
Now, you just mentioned that you worked a lot in Russia. You visited, I heard you say that you visited every single Russian chemical weapons stockpile until it was destroyed last year. The Green Cross has been very active in Russia. It's done enormous things in this country for the environment. And yet, in this new East-West standoff, you side fully and unquestionably with the Western narrative. Why did you choose that position as opposed to, let's say, trying to be neutral, as we would, I argue, expect from a representative of an international organization?
We have been neutral, Oksana. We've been very neutral. I think we've bent over backwards to be as neutral as we can. But when the fact-finding mission of the Chemical Weapons Convention was established in just 4 years ago, in April or May of 2014, we waited and went through all the reports. I've met with the OPCW inspectors. You know, that's a multilateral inspection group. It includes Russian inspectors, includes American, includes, I don't know, 15 or 20 different nationalities in the inspectorate. And then when the joint investigative mechanism was set up a year later in 2015 to try to look at accountability, in other words, try to find out who was to blame for these different attacks. It was clear to me after the fact-finding mission reports and the JIM reports, the Joint Investigative Mechanism from the United Nations, that these were very accurate, very thorough reports, and I was convinced. I still read them very thoroughly. I meet with the inspectors. I'm a skeptic. I'm in the non-governmental community, and Green Cross is trying to maintain objectivity here, but we want these attacks to stop wherever they, if it's Britain or whether it's Syria or Iraq. And we also want full proof.
Can I just seize on that? Because you say you want a full proof. You say that you subscribe to critical thinking, but you know very well that most fact-finding missions, unlike probably the latest one, relied on evidence that were submitted by other parties. In the most case, the opposition parties or state actors affiliated with the opposition, like Turkey. So the chain of custody has never been fully established. The JIM mechanism, the JIM probe that you mentioned, it has never visited the actual sites in Syria. And we all know that, you know, there is a lot of politics involved in the Syrian war. Let's not pretend that it is just the Syrian government fighting the opposition there. There are many foreign actors present there who have a very clear interest in manipulating the public narrative. Are you discounting all of that?
No, we're not discounting. I don't think any of that. I would question about the chain of command. What I was about to say earlier, though, is remember, we're in a war zone here. And the OPCW inspectorate, which has existed since 1997, has inspected, the safe and sound destruction of over 69,000 metric tons of live agent, the majority of it in Russia, a large amount in the United States and in six other countries. They've been very accurate. They're very experienced, very well trained. But the entrance into Syria in 2013, after Syria signed the Chemical Weapons Convention, was the very first time that they had to measure themselves for bulletproof vests and actually face potential life and death situations. So we're dealing with a very difficult inspection situation. Nobody can get on site to any of these alleged chemical weapons attacks for days afterward, sometimes weeks afterward. There's all sorts of options, opportunities for these, for the data, for the photographs, for the videos, for the evidence to be manipulated or staged. I totally agree with that. But if you read the FFM reports and the JIM reports that have operated in full cooperation with the Syrian government, full cooperation with whatever forces they were fighting in those regions, the including the intelligence from a wide variety of sources, forensic evidence, blood samples, urine samples, interviews with the medical doctors, you find that these the few that we know about, we only know about a few of the couple of hundred alleged attacks. The few we know about pretty much, I think, thoroughly prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I think 100% would be stretching it, but beyond a reasonable doubt that the Syrians have undertaken at least five attacks, Syrian government, and the ISIS Islamic State has undertaken at least two attacks.
Well, Mr. Walker, you mentioned the victims' blood and urine samples before, and we're already hearing similar reports from Western, particularly American media, that the victims' blood and urine samples tested positive for chlorine. And I've spoken to a number of experts in organic chemistry, and they all say that molecular chlorine could simply not be found in the biological materials. It reacts too quickly. It converts to chloride, which is a natural component of blood and urine. I have here a printout from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services guide for chlorine. And it also states that there are no biomarkers that can be used to quantify exposure to chlorine gas. How is it possible that Western scientists would so quickly discover something for which a scientific test does not even exist?
You know, I don't know, Oksana, if chlorine samples can be taken. I'm not a physician. I'm not a chemist.
But you mentioned the blood and urine samples earlier.
I did. And what they have found is sarin and any of your nerve agents leave residue markers in the blood, on the bodies, in the soil. Chlorine is very, is very volatile, evaporates very quickly. I agree, disassociates very quickly. But nerve agents do not, for the most part. It all depends on the weather and the rain and everything else going on at the scene. But what I was referring to is blood samples with signs of sarin agent attack in it. And we've found that over and over again. In Khanshakun last year, Talmenis.
Exactly. We heard the same claim following the Khanshakun attack. And I'm sure you heard that the U.S. Defense Secretary, Mr. Mattis, just recently, but I think it was in February, stated that the United States, till this day, does not have forensic evidence for the use of sarin in Khanshakun. He was referring specifically to that attack. I suppose he had access to the same report that you mentioned by Jim, or perhaps by the fact-finding mission. How is it possible that the United States, with all the intelligence, with all the forces it has on the ground, cannot secure the very same samples that, you know, opposition groups or Turkey could provide to the OPCW investigators?
Well, the OPCW tries to maintain chain of custody. You mentioned earlier, you want, you know, every inspector that goes in, the team wants to maintain 100% chain of custody. In other words, the sampling they have ideally taken by them and under their control until they get to the OPCW designated laboratories. And if you don't have full chain of command, which, you know, is very likely in most, if not all, of these cases, due to the fact that you can't get to the sites and you can't get to the victims or the medical personnel for probably a week later. I mean, here in Duma, we're dealing with, over a week later where they are now. You have to read the FFM and the Jim reports very carefully, look at the sampling techniques. On the whole, I would continue to say all evidence points towards the Syrian government. It's not just, you know, videos. It's not just blood samples either. It's eyewitness reports of and also intelligence on aircraft vectoring helicopters. Most of these bombs, except in the case of the ISIS two strikes, came from the air, came from barrel bombs or weapons dropped from the air. And there's only one fighting force in Syria today that has helicopters and aircraft. And we know who that is.
Well, Dr. Walker, let me stop you here just for a second. We need to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Paul Walker, Director of Green Cross International's Environmental Security and Sustainability Program. Mr. Walker, just before the break, you mentioned barrel bombs as supposedly the most typical weapon, the weapon of choice for the Syrian army. And the Pentagon just released its assessment suggesting that it believes barrel bombs were used in the case of the Duma attack to deliver the chemicals. One of such barrel bombs was filmed in the bedroom of the building where that attack supposedly took place. And it supposedly came through a small opening in the roof, flew across the room around 5 or 7 meters, landed on the bed without damaging the bed or even the blanket underneath it, without having any visible scratches or dents on the shell itself, with its fins still being intact. That's supposedly after crashing through the reinforced concrete of the ceiling. Does this all look straightforward to you?
That's another new story, Oksana. I'm not sure that's at all truthful. I never heard that story before, but I have heard Syrian and Russian diplomats again and again tell these extraordinary stories about how these weapons could not go straight down a smokestack or straight through a room or whatever. None of that are in the FFM or the Jim reports. I've not seen any of that before. And I know all the reports indicate where the bombs landed, where the likely bombs landed. There were craters in the roads or in the house or the room, whatever it is. I'm very loath to believe these reports about bouncing off beds and coming straight down smokestacks. It just is so unbelievable. And I would urge everyone to look at all the evidence, Oksana. But, I'm the first to say, because this is in a war zone and we cannot have inspectors there, perhaps even in many cases ever on site, so we'll never know, where 80 or 90% of these attacks have come from. You have to put it in the whole context of the war. And the Syrian government is the only one with helicopters and aircraft. The Syrian government, as far as we know, is the only country there which has just recently given up a very large stockpile. And the Declaration Assessment Team, a group we call the DAT, the DAT, mm-hmm. I hate to use these acronyms, but the Declaration Assessment Team, which assesses the initial declaration from a new state party, a new member state of the OPSW, has gone to Damascus now at least 15 times, maybe more, and still cannot find all the evidence that it's asked Syria for. So there's a whole series of questions that Syria has been either unwilling or unable to answer.
It's hardly surprising that there is a lot of mistrust on the Syrian side when you have one attack after another, which has also lots of unanswered questions, which has lots of red flags. And yet all the blame is put on the Syrian government, because I just gave you an example of a video where a barrel bomb is positioned at a place where it could not be positioned. If you actually take physics and velocity and all of that seriously, that is just impossible. I mean, you need to take physics 101 to understand that it's not possible for a barrel bomb to fly through the roof. And that video was provided by the same activists who submitted the videos of the victims.
I don't believe those reports. I know Russia and some other, and the Syrians certainly, and maybe at times the Iranians are trying to push some of these stories. These stories are really not very credible at all. And I'm a scientist. I'm the first one to look for all the evidence. And I've been critical of all governments there. We all want the war to stop. We want no chemical weapons used. We want no violence, period. And I think the part of the reason is because we cannot get a diplomatic solution either in the Geneva process or in the Astana process in Kazakhstan. So I'm all in favor of a diplomatic solution, stopping the violence and all of this. I'm also for finding whoever is using illegal, inhumane, globally banned chemical weapons, bringing them before the International Criminal Court and imprisoning them. And I think in the end, all of this will go before the court. But I'm willing to bet if we both went to the court, if there were a trial of Bashar al-Assad today, he would be found guilty before the international court.
Mr. Walker, if your country, the United States, were not allowed to manipulate the court, the composition of the court, I'm actually not sure how the verdict would be out. But you said about the evidence. I want to pursue that route because I think it's very, very important. You are very critical of the Syrian government. You made it very clear that you hold it responsible. So let's talk about the other side. And the other side, the videos that both the French intelligence and we know them, American government based its findings on, its conclusions on. They said it out loud in their official statements that they based their conclusions on social media reports, on public source information. And one of such videos includes children's corpses being moved around, clearly rearranged in different positions, apparently for emotional impact. In several cases, we can see the same bodies with the foam on their mouths, and in other cases, there is no foam. We sent you pictures before of a foam trail, which really looks pretty unnatural, and I think most people would agree that it looks as if it was applied with the help of a dispenser. I wonder what are your thoughts on that? Do you at the very least question the motives and the actions of the side that would be also very, very interested in finding in the international community agreeing that it was Assad who was behind it? But at the end of the day, it wasn't the Assad soldiers who were carrying children's corpses around and putting them in all those manipulating positions.
Well, first of all, I guess I saw those photos, and thank you for sending them to me, Oksana. These photos are horrible. It's one of the things I think that moves a lot of viewers towards becoming very concerned and worried about the whole civil war in Syria today. I can't judge whether these, and I don't think OP7 inspectors judge either, whether these photos are extremely accurate or could have been manipulated. I would assume some of them clearly could have been easily manipulated. Foam coming from the mouth, you just don't know. Sometimes foam is extreme. You know, it's like dilated pupils, too, or constricted pupils as well, the eyes. You just don't know when the photos were taken, how long the body was, the poor child or the individual was dead. It's very difficult. And that's why I say we can't make any judgments on these attacks based on photos of that nature. We clearly know at some point somebody was hit with some sort of a chemical. They look like they were victims of chemical warfare, no other wounds on the body at all. But we can't even tell that because they're fully clothed. They could have been reclothed. So I'm just saying we need multiple sources of information to prove these cases. And in the dozen or so cases that the gym and the fact-finding mechanism from a mission from the OPSW used, I'm quite convinced that what they've concluded is correct, that Syria has been found guilty of probably the Syrian government of about five, maybe it's up to six cases now, if Duma, whatever we see from Duma this week from the fact-finding mission. And the ISIS, Islamic State, has been found guilty of at least two uses of mustard. We don't know where these chemicals are coming from, except now, apparently, you know, according to at least the Americans, the British and the French, and others who supported them, maybe the Baza, you know, scientific research facility was still doing work. But the inspections that have gone on by the OPSW in Syria over the last 5 years, you know, have not proven any major production of chemicals, any hidden stockpile or anything. So that still remains an open question.
But Dr. Walker, we are talking here about the upholding of a major global norm on the prohibition of the use of chemical weapons. And there are clear signs here that one of the parties, Jaish al-Islam, an Al-Qaeda affiliate, which was accused by Amnesty International of using chemical weapons against the Kurds in 2016, this party is clearly involved in manipulating the evidence to create the impression that chemical weapons were used. If it's okay for them to use children's corpses like that, do you think they would really think twice about using chlorine for real, given how easily available it is?
You know, chlorine is very accessible. It's not banned necessarily. It's not banned at all in the Chemical Weapons Convention, but it is banned. Any chemical is banned if it's used as a weapon, no matter what it is. Any toxic chemical. Manipulation of these pictures, your question, I say again, I think they can be manipulated, but I think it's still useful to see some of these. These victims look like, in fact, they were hit with some sort of chemical. And the other question is, if it was dropped with barrel bombs or aerial bombs, which is many times the case, from helicopters and aircraft, and if Syrian aircraft and helicopters were vectoring over that very site at the same time where all this happened, it's pretty clear to me that the Syrian government is to blame for this. I don't see any other explanation. The Al-Qaeda groups, Islamic State, they have no aircraft, no helicopters.
They could easily have brought some barrel bombs or some destroyed shells to that very site, as I think happened in Duma. I mentioned to you the case of this huge cylinder lying on bed, you know, without damaging bed or even the blanket underneath it. How much physics does it take to figure out that this would be highly unlikely?
I think, you know, the OPCW inspectors have looked at all of that, Oksana, and I can't answer every single instance. You know, I've never been to Syria. I know the access of the OPCW inspectors has been limited to a week or two after or later after these incidents. I think you just have to read the reports well, and you'll find that on the whole, there are obviously further questions, many of which you've raised, which I think are very fair. On the whole, these fact-finding mission and Jim reports have been very accurate. What bothers me most right now is we need the Jim, the Joint Investigative Mechanism, under the United Nations auspices to continue. And Russia has vetoed the extension of the Jim, even after personnel have been changed in the Jim several times. And these are all multilateral operations, including Russian inspectors and officials.
Absolutely.
As well.
But Mr. Walker, I'm sure you know that Russia has offered its own composition of how the joint investigative mechanism could be structured. I mean, I don't believe that a person who is so involved right. in the subject like you wouldn't know about that. You know that Russia also submitted its own draft and the United States vetoed it. So please don't deprive our viewers of the context here, because there were actually three resolutions that were put on the draft resolutions put on the table, and sure, Russian was vetoed, and the American was vetoed.
Well, it'll be important for some sort of independent investigative mechanism that everyone finds fair, including multilateral inspectors from a dozen countries. We don't want a Russian inspection. We don't want an American inspection. We don't want an Iraqi inspection or a Syrian inspection. We want a multilateral inspectorate, which is what the fact-finding mission is all about, what the Jim was all about. And I don't understand, having read the Russian proposals, why Russia cannot agree on a fully independent, multilateral, international inspectorate going forward to try to find accountability.
Well, I can tell you that. I think it believes that the United States tries to manipulate the Jim mechanism through structuring it in a way that is most beneficial for its aims. Rather than debating about it, because I think we made our views pretty clear, can I ask you one more thing? Because, the alternative explanation to everything that we've discussed today in Russia is that what we are witnessing in Syria goes back to Barack Obama's August 2012 statement on the red lines and the intensified efforts on the part of various state and non-state actors to make sure that the United States is drawn into the conflict, that it stays in Syria for as long as it takes, and hopefully takes the side of not only militants or the rebels, but also the anti-Iranian side. That would be the Israeli interest, for example. Do you find this explanation plausible at all?
You know, I wish the peace process, the Geneva diplomatic peace process, would have taken hold much earlier. I think Obama drew a red line and never fulfilled his threats, I suppose, or predictions. On the other hand, I also don't support President Trump's unilateral actions either. But those of us who've worked on this crisis for the last five or more years are very frustrated, and were frustrated long before when the rebel groups in Syria had to resort to violence to try to oppose Bashar al-Assad's really inhumane, cruel, long-time tactics of torture and ugly behavior as a dictator in Syria. And I think everyone has a little bit to blame. I agree. I'm not sure what the United States could have done more. You know, we haven't done military action directly as we have the last year with President Trump. Maybe we should have done that earlier. But I'm in favor of multilateral responses, not unilateral action. And I must say, we're also very critical of Russia's support for such a horrible dictator in Damascus. And we all hope for the Syrian people that we can find a good resolution to this. In fact, we can develop democratic processes in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East as well.
Dr. Walker, we have to leave it there. The only thing I can say is that from my experience of talking to many Syrians, both on the pro-Assad side and the opposition side, they certainly don't want any help from the United States when it comes to democracy building. please apply those efforts elsewhere, for example, in Saudi Arabia. And I think it would also help turning some of your attention to the treatment of human beings there. But anyway, Dr. Walker, you've been very gracious and very patient with me. Thank you very much for participating in this conversation. I also encourage our viewers to keep it going on our social media pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.